there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, an hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, maybe a little health politics, given the climate of the times, and answers to your emails and phone calls live on the air here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We've got lots of things going on today, and I'm going to start off with talking about sandcastles. Now it's summer and we're all getting out there on the beach, and what we really need to do is wash our hands before eating. A recent paper just published talks about the frequency of gastrointestinal illnesses, very big in people who've been playing in the sand. So researchers at the National Epidemiological Environmental Assessment of Recreational Water Study interviewed 27,000 people who were at 7 marine and freshwater sites. All of them were within a few miles of sewage plant discharges, but actually the source of the infectious sand might have been runoff or other sources. The big problem is that when they talked to these people, within 2 weeks, about 13% of them had developed gastrointestinal troubles of those who had dug in the sand. And if you counted the people who buried themselves in the sand, it was up to 23%, or 1 out of 4, who developed GI symptoms within a week of having that experience. So germs out there in them thar sandcastles, folks. Be sure you wash your hands before eating. That lovely picnic on the beach might be something you pay for several days later if you're not careful. Well, I'm sure if you've been paying attention to healthcare in the news this week, you know that the House passed a bill for healthcare reform. And this bill is not so bad, in my opinion. It does have the two things that I feel are absolutely critical, which is it has a mandate that people have to buy health insurance. And if you don't buy health insurance or can't show proof of it, you pay the penalty in the form of a new tax on your income. It does have a government health plan that people can purchase, and people who have access to this health plan would be people with modest incomes or people who don't have insurance through their employers. Or, and I like this one, if the cost of the employer coverage would take up more than 11% of the family income, then you can also buy into the plan. Employers would, in general, have to pay for health care for their employees. The fee would be about 8% of wages for an employer with an annual payroll of more than $400,000. And if you had an employee payroll of less than $250,000, you would not have to pay any fee or penalty. So not exactly a killer for small business. There's arguments about whether or not this is a good idea or a bad idea, letting the employers off the hook. There's many editorials out there saying that, well, a lot of employers who currently offer health insurance will opt out because it's cheaper to pay the fine. And, you know, that might be true in places where there's not competition for employees. But speaking as a small business person, I can tell you that once you've trained someone and they're doing their job, it's a lot easier to retain that person than retrain another. And to the extent that people use benefits as a basis for staying in a lower-end job as opposed to salary, I think having a good health plan is still something that many small businessmen will continue to do. On the other hand, this does go a very, very long way to covering the people who currently don't have coverage. It would get the number of uninsured down to 13 million. And the estimates are that of that 13 million, about half would be quote-unquote illegal immigrants, whatever that means. I don't know what the other half is, and the papers I've been looking at don't say. But I wanted to share that information with you and suggest that you talk to your senator. The Senate is still deliberating. It's very important that both bills go to conference committee with an individual mandate and a government option. If we don't get those two things, we don't get our foot in the door on meaningful healthcare reform, which I hope that most of my listeners actually do support. I have something that Jim in Big Sur sent me that I'm going to post on the website. It was written by Joanne Fields, an MD in Dover, Delaware, and it's called The Declaration of Independence from Commercial Health Insurance. It's written in the style of the Declaration of Independence, and I found it very amusing and also a good description of the issues as they appear to, well, this side of the fence. Not being in government and insulated by a really good socialized medicine program, but instead being in the trenches of the healthcare debacle that we currently face, which is literally a meltdown of rationality in the system, I'm hoping for better. So I hope you'll look at that on the website, askdrdon.com, and please comment on it. Well, let me read you the first few lines. When it becomes evident to all reasonable people that our current healthcare industry needs significant reform, respect for the opinions of friends and adversaries requires that we should declare the causes which impel reform. We believe that all men, women, and children are created equal and are endowed with the right to health and well-being. And then it goes on from there. It's really quite beautifully written, and I very much enjoyed it. I also have on the website, courtesy of my producer, Charles Mansky, links to interviews on Democracy Now! And on Bill Moyer's Journal with Wendell Potter. Wendell Potter is a former big healthcare insurance executive, Humana, I believe, who turned whistleblower and is now getting a lot of airtime exposing the policies of the health insurance companies, the way they think about the public, and the way they fool people into buying what they think is good health insurance, but which turns out to be an incredible bait and switch. And we're going now to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I have a question for a friend who has a blood test, and his iron saturation is 7, and the range is 20 to 45, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He had low iron, also 30, and the range is 44 to 130. But the hemoglobin is just down a little bit. It's 11.9, and the range is 13-something to 18. And so he's concerned about this might have an effect upon one of his eyes, which has a retina that has been compromised from glaucoma. He has cupping and limited eyesight in the eye from field vision.
Mm-hmm.
So he's wondering what this iron saturation, if it's serious or mean too much or what.
Well, let me ask a couple of questions. How old is your friend?
75.
75. And does he have any reason to be losing blood? Does he have a bleeding ulcer, or has he been operated on recently? Anything like that?
He had an operation a year ago, but
any kidney problems? His kidney's good as far as he knows?
He had one kidney.
He has one kidney. Okay. So a couple of things. First of all, when a person has low iron, there are two reasons that you could have low iron. And one of them is losing it. You're eating iron, you're absorbing it okay, but you're losing it. And the most common reason in older people is occult GI blood loss. So either a bleeding ulcer, a little oozing because he takes aspirin every day. Worst case scenario, a colon cancer that's bleeding. So we always stop and think about colon cancer when we see anemia in people who are, well, the older you are, the higher your risk for colon cancer, but especially above 50 is when it starts to show up. So those would be considerations, and he probably does need to be evaluated for occult GI blood loss. The other thing is, because he only has one kidney, the kidney is responsible for the blood, which is, oddly enough, is something that comes out of Chinese medicine, which there's no way they could have known that. It's amazing to me that they figured that out. But the traditional Chinese medicine, the kidney is in charge of blood. In fact, the kidney is in charge of blood through a hormone called erythropoietin that the kidney excretes and that stimulates the bone marrow to make new red blood cells. You may have heard of this. It's called EPO-A, and sometimes the Tour de France guys get caught giving themselves extra injections of it to beef up their red blood cells before the race. So you may have read about that in the sports section, actually. Anyway, so he has two reasons. The one kidney means maybe the kidney he's got at 79 isn't putting out enough of this important blood hormone. But the fact that his iron is low suggests that he's losing it somewhere, or, and I'm coming back around to, you eat the iron and do you absorb it? Now, some people's intestines, as they age, have problems absorbing things like iron and B12. So it may be that he has malabsorption of iron, so he's just not getting it in very well. And that's a little bit more difficult to prove. And the treatment for that is that you give larger doses of supplements, and you can sometimes even give iron intramuscularly. So that can be done in a pinch. But the very first thing for him, the implication is we need to make sure he doesn't have something wrong in his colon or his stomach that's leading to this blood loss.
Actually, he has had the test where they look in the colon and also look in the stomach, and they haven't been able to find anything.
Good. I'm really glad he had those tests because, you know, you'd hate to miss the elephant in the room.
And the problem with they give him a prescription for iron, and he's been taking that, but it doesn't seem to help.
Well, he may not be absorbing it. Now, your question was around his retina. Directly speaking, glaucoma is not made worse by mild anemia, which is what your friend has.
Okay.
However, that being said, you don't really like to have people with mild anemia because the red blood cells carry oxygen to all of the tissues of the body, and that includes the brain and the heart and the kidney and everything, really. So it's an extra strain on the body that you really don't need. So I would urge him to try different forms of iron. What's usually prescribed is ferrous sulfate by doctors. It's the cheapest one. But there are other forms. There's ferrous gluconate. There's ferrous sulfate. Taking that with orange juice or with a little vinegar can sometimes help in the absorption. So there's little tricks. A nutritionist might be able to help him with, or a naturopathic doctor, someone who's studied nutrition. You're unfortunately, and I'm saying this having gone through conventional medical training, our conventional medical training neglected basic nutrition, and it neglected particularly how to address nutritional issues. We just don't have any training in that. And so we tend to just do what we were taught and not go out and look for other solutions. Doctors are busy people, and they don't stop and do the research. They aren't aware of their own shortcomings in knowledge base, which is, you know, something that needs to be remedied, but that's the situation. So I think it's up to your friend to go out and maybe play in alternative land a little bit and try to improve his iron absorption at this point.
Okay. Thank you so much for your help.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
So I wanted to share this email. This is Mary from Georgia writing. She says, on your July 11th show, a young woman called in with what she thought was atopic eczema. I have a friend, now 47, who has been in, had serious trouble with atopic eczema since she was a child. Multiple doctors over the years have been able to do very little for her, except sort out the many things her skin reacts to and treat major outbreaks with immune suppressants. Last year, I heard on your broadcast, I think, that vitamin D helps repair the basic defect in the structure of the skin that causes the problem. I passed this on to her, and a few months later, she reported gleefully that 4,000 units a day of vitamin D had completely solved her problem. But you didn't mention vitamin D on your July 11th program, so I thought I'd send in this testimonial that it can be miraculously effective. So, just wanted to share that with you. Thank you very much to Mary in Georgia. This next email from Meg in Santa Cruz, black cohosh and platelets. I think Meg's got scientific background. I'm going to read you this whole thing. I'm diagnosed with primary thrombocytosis, for which I take Agrilin. It has managed my disorder extremely well. My platelet count remains between 2 and 300. I happened to notice that my platelet count dropped after I started taking black cohosh. So I ran a personal ABA experiment after getting my hematologist-oncologist permission. Here are the results, with the no and yes referring to the period prior to the CBC. So, she gives me this lovely table, gives her Agrinox dose, gives her platelet count, and then gives whether or not she's been on black cohosh. I'm not going to try to read you the table, but what it shows is that when she gets her platelets done after having been on black cohosh, her platelets are, well, let's see, 217 to 137. So, you know, a 60%, 70% of what they were off the black cohosh. Then she goes off the black cohosh, platelets climb, then back on, platelets drop. At that point, I stopped taking black cohosh because my hot flashes were mostly resolved. I tried briefly switching over to the black cohosh entirely, but could not tolerate the symptoms of withdrawal from the Agrilin. I don't know if this was an interaction particular to me, to Agrilin black cohosh, or to the black cohosh alone, or to something else. However, I imagine I'm not the only hot flashing primary thrombocytosis diagnosed Agrilin and black cohosh taken woman among your listeners. probably not the only one, but I think you're in a distinct minority, Meg. If this is a side effect of the black cohosh alone, most women would never discover it because most of us do not get periodic CBCs, and I thought this might be of interest to you. Thank you, Meg, for a couple of things. First of all, thank you for the information. I will certainly do a little looking. I'm going to start by looking at which cytochrome P450's black cohosh is metabolized through and which one's agrelin is metabolized to. I think that might be the low-hanging fruit as far as the reason for your issue. It looks like a metabolic reaction interfering with breakdown of the agrelin and thus causing the agrelin to have a greater effect. So what that could mean, it'd be like the grapefruit and cyclosporin effect. We know that grapefruit juice interferes with one of these cytochromes, happens to be the one that breaks down cyclosporin. So if you're giving this very expensive immune rejection drug to people and they like grapefruit juice, you have to be careful because they may get over immunosuppressed. But if you're trying to save money and you can get them to drink grapefruit juice every day, then you can actually use it to stretch the dose of the medication. And I think the idea of exploiting this competitive inhibition, as it's called, in the breakdown of drugs is something that needs to be explored a little bit further. I believe that there's actually great potential for both cost savings and also for maybe reducing side effects. But we have the information. It's complicated enough, and we don't have good, inexpensive assays for the strength of the cytochromes in various people. We have good expensive assays, but not good inexpensive, widely available ones. So it's a place where clinical management lags way behind our science. And I'm very interested in what happens with the new generation of doctors, whether or not they're going to be better educated about the cytochromes. You can get both inhibition and actually enhancement of breakdown of drugs. And so it's very much a case-by-case scenario. But that information is actually in the physician's drug reference. The drug companies do actually list which cytochromes break down their drugs, but nobody's doing good tables. No one's really looking at the interactions in a nice deductive fashion and putting together clinical tools that are useful. We're missing the boat there on that one. In the law of unintended consequences category, this article about a recent report, let's see, where was this published? This was published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. The research involved more than 3,000 patients at 100 different sites around the country. And it was a byproduct of a study where they were looking at an experimental drug. But it relates to an innovation that began about 10 years ago. Now, let's rewind about 20 years ago when a person needed a coronary artery bypass graft. In other words, a new blood vessel grafted onto their heart because they'd blocked one of the major arteries. The old method of doing it was to harvest a vein from the leg, and one would actually slit open the skin over the greater saphenous vein, which is in the medial inside portion of the leg, and dissect out the vein, tie off the little feeders, and produce this sort of long tube and hand it over to the surgeon, who would then use that for the bypass grafts. I actually assisted these surgeries, and for me, surgery is fun. It's eye-hand coordination. I'm a sculptor, so, you know, it's flesh sculpting. It's enjoyable at a motor eye-hand coordination skill level of enjoyment. But the new method that was introduced initially about 10 years ago, but then became very popular because it left a better scar, was to use the technique that was used for varicose vein stripping, which is you would make several little horizontal incisions at intervals and then put a kind of a stopper in the vein, thread a thread up the vein, and then give it a good hard yank. And by doing that, you could produce a segment of vein that would essentially gather up onto a stopper and string device and then open that up, pull it off of the stopper and string, and hand that off to the surgeon. Unfortunately, now that we've got 10 years of data, it seems that people who had the small incision method were significantly more likely to die, suffer a heart attack, or need another artery opening procedure within 3 years of their bypass. Now, presumably, this is because taking the vein out in the minimal scarring method actually created maximal scarring and inflammation in the vein, and therefore made it more likely that the graft patency, in other words, that the graft would not remain open. More research is needed to confirm this, but in the meantime, if you need a bypass and you're offered the option of a big scar on your leg versus a few little scars, just this one report alone would make me want to consider taking the big scar. After all, a big scar on your leg is nothing compared to having to have another open heart procedure or having to have another heart attack. And we're going to Charlene in Aptos. Hello, Charlene, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thanks. I wanted to talk about kind of a little bit of a gross subject, foot fungus.
Okay.
And I've had it for probably 10 years, and I'm getting tired of it. And I was wondering, it's the kind of foot fungus where it's kind of opaque white stuff, and it's primarily on the big toe and then the next two.
Is this toenails we're talking about?
Toenails.
Yes, okay.
Toenails.
Just to specify, yes.
Yeah, and I don't know. I want to see if I can find some over-the-counter. I don't have health insurance at this time. Or is there something I can do to get rid of it that might help?
Okay. A toenail fungus, and actually, now that we're in the age of acrylic nails, fingernail fungus are fairly common problems. First of all, I had a caller, low these many years, who told me that tea tree oil worked, and I tried it on my own toenail fungus, and I can testify that it did work for me. So I started putting that out there as, you know, lore remedy, no research associated with it, and getting back positives from a lot of the people who tried it. So tea tree oil, apply to the nail, and basically when you get out of the shower, you abrade the nail, rough it up a little bit with an emery board, and put the tea tree oil on there and rub it in. Now, about 10% of people who use tea tree oil daily will get a dermatitis, so watch for dermatitis. If you get that, you have to abandon this strategy. But it's fairly effective. It inhibits further growth of the fungus. It's a pretty good antifungal. And if it's working, what will happen is the area of white will get smaller and smaller.
I tried the tea tree oil, you know, I don't know, maybe for 3 or 4 days. I mean, do you have to try it for like every day for 3 weeks? Or?
Oh, yeah. You have to try it for a while because the nail grows slowly. And so the discoloration, that's not going to disappear. That nail is damaged. It has to grow out. It's like if you dye your hair,
yeah,
it's going to grow out from the roots.
Okay.
Okay. And that's true, by the way, of even the medical therapies. If you take the pills for toenail fungus, you're still going to have the ugly white spot on your nail until the toenail grows out.
So is that fungus on the top throughout the nail or on the inside of the nail? I wonder where it's located.
Mostly throughout the nail.
Throughout the nail.
The nail's in layers,
okay,
like one of those pastries, those really flaky pastries.
Okay.
And so the fungus grows between the flakes. That's why the nail gets thicker. As it grows between the layers of nail, it expands and kind of puffs up.
Okay. So you just say, try to apply that tea tree oil once a day or so for a couple weeks, and I should see, or just months?
You're going to have to do it for months for the nail to grow out. There's no quick fix here. Now, let me tell you about another thing in case the tea tree oil doesn't work for you, which is an NONYX, which I think is pronounced Nonyx. It is an over-the-counter product, and it's about 70% effective. It's an inhibitory acid, so again, you have to wait for the nail to grow out. There's no fix for the cosmetics on this, no quick fix.
Okay.
And, of course, it's summer. And are they running those Lamisil ads again on TV? I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, there's this lovely 10 years ago when they started running ads. This was one of the first direct-to-consumer ads. It was classic. It was like body odor things in the 1960s, you know, make people self-conscious about something about their body and then offer to sell them a cure.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had these people, you know, on the beach, gorgeous babe is on the beach, but, you know, she's got ugly toenails, so she's all, you know, sensitive about her toenails and burying them in the sand, and this pill will help. Anyway, so just a little commentary on advertising.
Well, does that work or no?
Well, the Nonyx is about 70% effective.
Uh-huh.
There is a prescription strength nail, toenail fungus polish product called Penlac, P-E-N-L-A-C. That's FDA approved for the purpose and is prescription. And it's about 60% effective in clinical trials. So that sometimes these nail lacquer type products do work. They're worth a try. Certainly before you go to systemic therapy.
Okay, and does Lamisil work?
Lamisil has been shown in clinical trials to clear toenail fungus. So, yes, that does work.
Is that over the counter or you?
No, it's about $600 for a course. So
forget that.
Yeah. And so we can kind of drop that one.
Okay.
That's what paid for that fancy TV ad, though.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll pass on that one. But all right. Well, thanks. You've given me some options, so I'll give it a try.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye bye. I have an email here from Jen in Wisconsin. Dear Dr. Don, I recently heard about a cancer-specific antigen CSA blood test that could be used to detect cervical cancer. Supposedly, this test is even more accurate than the pap smear. I'm 40 years old and have extreme anxiety about medical exams and haven't ever been able to undergo a pap smear. A simple blood test would be a godsend to me, but my doctor has never offered it as an option. Is this test widely available? Why aren't doctors offering it as an alternative to the more invasive test? I would think they'd get a lot more compliance for cervical cancer testing if there was an alternative like this. Many thanks for your fine program. And this was the first I'd heard about the CSA test. Of course, I went and did a little Google search and found the website for Onconix, Inc., which specializes in in vitro cancer diagnostic. And they had some discussion of their CSA test. It detects a molecule that's very elevated in early precursor stages of cervical cancer. It does not detect adenocarcinoma of the cervix, which is cancer of the glandular tissue inside the cervix, which you do pick up on a pap smear. So, well, it is often detected on a pap smear. It's not as easily detected, I should say. But anyway, this is there. It is out there and available. I have not seen any local labs offering it, and I did look into the literature and see exactly what was going on here and what they were tested. And I found, to my surprise, that there was an extensive literature about two markers that appear to be very good and have high predictive value for cervical cancer. Now, cervical cancer evolves over several stages. First, you have slightly abnormal cells. These cells then progress to clearly abnormal cells, at which point you call it cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, or CIN, C-I-N. And these cells were different biochemically. They produce higher levels of something called insulin growth factor 2 and insulin growth factor binding protein 3. Now, obviously, IGF binding protein probably binds the growth factor. And if you don't bind the growth factor, well, then you have more growth. And that seems to be what's going on in these cancers. So a marker between high IGF-2 and low IGF binding protein 3 has been demonstrated in many different clinical trials to have great predictive value for cervical cancer. And most of these trials have been done first in tissue culture, but then there have been numerous trials looking at smears of women who have known cervical cancer, who are being treated for cervical cancer, or who have precancer and are being treated for that. And one of the things that happens is as you successfully treat cervical cancer, the blood levels of the IGF-2 drop and the blood levels of the IGF binding protein increase. So this is a very favorable sort of thing. It could be used to monitor therapy and certainly monitor for successful therapy. Many of the therapies we do, like freezing or cryotherapy, or sometimes we'll use chemical techniques, or we'll do a minimally invasive surgery. We don't really know, once we've done that, whether we got all of the cancer or got all of the precancer, and we sort of have to wait around. So I see initially this sort of blood testing being done to monitor therapy. It will take a long time, I think, before we can be sure that the sensitivity of this is good enough to replace screening. But in a person like the one who sent this email, Jen, who is saying essentially, I'm never getting a pap smear, lady. So if I can have this instead, at least I'm getting some partial reassurance and some partial screening. And it does look, Jen, like you might be able to find someone who would draw the blood and run it for you. You're going to need to go to this Onconix Inc. website, and you can find that by a Google search, and contact them and see who in your state has purchased this test. You're almost certainly going to be paying for this out of pocket, but cervical cancer screening, good idea. if your pap smears, cheap, easy, effective, and they're not 100% reliable by any stretch of the imagination, but they've made a huge difference in cervical cancer rates in our society, and they've saved literally millions of lives. So they're pretty darn good. And it'll have to gain a track record, as far as I'm concerned, before I'm willing to replace pap smears with a blood test. But it's interesting information. It's available, and it seems very plausible and legitimate. So that's my take on it. Hope you found it helpful. Let's go now to Aaron in Monterey. Hello, Aaron, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm having a pretty good day.
So what can I do for you?
Yes, ma'am. I'm a soldier who just got back last May. About 8 months after I came back from Iraq, I started having somewhat kind of mood swings. It was more where I would have severe chest pains, just feeling really, really sick, and it made me really hostile to everyone around me. And then, like, someone flipped the light switch, it would just go away and I'd be fine again. I'd be sitting there like, wow, I said some really mean stuff just now for no reason. And my run time for PT tests has gone down significantly over time. I dropped smoking, something that would help. And it just doesn't seem like it has, and I'm wondering if something could have been from burn pits possibly, because I was around those a lot.
Burn pits?
Kind of affected my lungs. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, what were they burning in the burn pits?
Anything and everything. Any kind of garbage you can imagine. We didn't have trash pickup.
So
if we used it, if it was a gas can or batteries, I know people threw away batteries and they weren't supposed to. We've had bullets go off, and it, you know, don't burn bullets, but people threw them in there anyway.
Don't burn bullets. Good safety tip. Okay, so first of all, yeah, I think that there is undoubtedly a connection between your smoke exposure and your loss of aerobic capacity that you're experiencing with your PT times, your running times. That's pretty much a no-brainer, and I think it could also be related to your chest pain. The thing I'm most worried about with your emotional mood swings is I'm worried about heavy metal toxicity. That's something that, particularly if they were burning batteries, batteries have lots of metal in them that can affect the central nervous system. And it sounds like you're having a breakdown in the higher centers of central nervous system where the inhibitory impulses are. Like, for example, you've seen it. Somebody starts drinking. They're just a really nice, sweet guy, and they get a couple of drinks under the belt, and they turn into this hostile person.
They're angry.
And what's happening there is that the higher part of the brain, the superficial level, if you will, its influence is to calm down the lower part of the brain. And it's the higher part of the brain happens to be the more sensitive to alcohol. So when you shut down the brain in stages, you go from being nice, the inhibitory is lost, and then whatever's underneath the nice, which in many people might be hostile, comes up. And then if you keep going, what's underneath the hostile, which is probably dopey and kind of just, you know, lolling about lazy, is down there, kind of the lizard brain. And eventually they stop breathing, but that takes a lot of alcohol.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, but it's kind of a stepwise shutdown. And it sounds like the higher centers are kind of browning out on you there. And that makes me worry mostly because of your exposure about heavy metal toxicity as a first thing. Now, since your exposure was 6 months ago, it won't show up necessarily in blood or urine unless the levels are very high. But you could start by getting a urine and a blood test for mercury and lead, which would be the two things I'd be most concerned about, and seeing if those are elevated. If they're even in the upper range of normal, I'd be concerned. But if they're above the normal range, then you've got your answer. And that is fairly straightforward. There's straightforward medical therapy to lower those levels, and that may be all that you require.
Would that possibly cause minor hallucinations or really vivid nightmares, things like that?
It could. It could.
Okay.
The other thing is, there's another kind of toxicity to being in a war zone, which is the psychological toxicity. And we have lots of people coming back with variations of post-traumatic stress.
Yes,
and some of those variations are really florid, you know, crazy Vietnam veteran going postal kind of stereotype, movie stereotype. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And then there's all these people who are just disrupted and troubled as a result of their wartime experience. There actually are a couple of bizarre drug strategies using beta blockers, which are just a blood pressure medicine, has been shown to be helpful for that sort of level of perturbation. Are you working? Are you working in the? Are you still in the military? What's your circumstance there?
Actually, right now I am traveling across country. I have not even gotten to my station in Monterey yet to be a linguist. After all this stuff started happening, I decided to re-enlist for a non-combat arms in the West.
Right. Okay, well,
I'll be learning.
Yeah, the Defense Language Institute is a wonderful institution, and it's one of the jewels in the crown, I'd say, of our military, so you're very lucky to be posted there, in my opinion. Plus, you get to live in a just gorgeous part of the world. And very good doctors here, too, speaking as one of them. So once you get here, go to the doctors on the base, talk to them about your concerns around heavy metal exposure, and see if you can get yourself tested.
All right.
And then I'm here. You can call me back when you've got results, and we'll talk it through.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call, and thank you for your service.
You're very welcome. You have a nice day.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Doug in Santa Cruz.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I heard you talking about the foot fungus thing, and I had that problem for quite a while, and I tried a number of things, including tea tree oil, and tea tree oil didn't seem to work for me. Maybe it wasn't was because I didn't use it long enough, but I found a lot of success with turmeric, of all things.
Now, did you put this yellow stuff, the turmeric powder, on your toe? Was that?
Yeah, I would clip my toenails back as best I could, and then I would apply that directly to it. I would put the powder on there and rub it in.
Really?
And rub it into all of the areas, and after a few weeks, it started to go away, and the only thing is you have this slight discolor, and you have to continue to do it, otherwise it seems to come back.
Right. Well, with toenail fungus, it's kind of typical that it will recur because it's the environment, stupid, right? You've got a place where fungus can grow. Fungal spores are everywhere.
Dark and moist.
Dark and moist, and in little interstices, nice little nooks and crannies for the mycelia to spread. And so guess what?
And if you use your feet a lot, then that heats them up, which causes a little bit of inflammation, and they like that environment.
It's the shoes. That's what it is. We should just all go barefoot and toenail fungus. Toenail fungus would be a thing of the past.
But I just thought I'd throw that in there as one little.
You.
I don't know exactly what it is. I know it's an anti-inflammatory and it's a free radical scavenger, so maybe.
It also has antibacterial properties when it's applied topically like that. So,
okay.
Turmeric is actually one of the mainstays of Balinese medicine. I've had the good fortune to travel to Bali on many occasions.
Oh, nice.
And when I studied the herbal medicine there, turmeric, or galangal, as it's called, is one of the big herbs.
Right.
It's kind of like garlic is in the Western pharmacopoeia. It's very, very important, and they use it as a topical a lot. They also use it for cold feet, for people who have circulatory problems.
Wow.
They make a paste of it and massage it in, and it's supposed to be very effective for that.
Maybe I should go and live in Bali then.
Oh, you should definitely go and live in Bali.
I figured that one out on my own.
Fabulous place.
Maybe I have some sort of connection there. The reason I called was I have insurance through the state. It's Medi-Cal.
Mm-hmm.
And I had coverage for a chiropractor.
Yeah.
I was having back problems related to a foot injury. I was completely, off of one foot. I was on crutches.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of rehabilitation to do relating to my right leg up to my back, to the hip and everything. So I was getting chiropractic treatment, and it was helping, and I got cut off through Medi-Cal. So I called up my doctor, and I asked if they write up a tarp. And he says, I don't believe in that stuff. He says, it's not doing you any good. I'm not going to write you up for that.
It's a TAR, treatment authorization request.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the doctor can do that.
Right. And sometimes they'll actually do it. One comment, all of this paperwork gets really onerous. And we're, as doctors, I'm going to say this is an excuse a little bit for your doctors. We're so sick of being asked to fill out forms for our patients to, you know, get stuff covered. They said, and I believe this is true, that the average primary care doctor spends something like 23 minutes a day, and it's $75,000 a year in terms of employee costs, filling out forms for the various insurance agencies. And unfortunately, TARS are one of them. So he's probably burned out on forms. That doesn't really give him an excuse not to fill it out for you. And as far as the I don't believe in that, well, there you got an issue, because doctors are, in fact, as a group, I'd say, split almost evenly about the usefulness of chiropractic. And there is a tendency, I think, to be very dismissive of a chiropractic, inappropriately so, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, now I have a back issue where I'm waking up in the morning and I'm getting like a sciatica thing where, you know, the nerves are just like all compromised in that right leg, and sometimes I can hardly even stand.
How's your foot and leg? Are you off the crutches now?
Oh, no, I've been off of that for a while.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah, no, that issue has all been resolved. It's now trying to, you know, get my muscles and my nerves and my alignment and my balance all back, and the chiropractic adjustment has been really helpful.
All right.
I know that when I don't get it, I don't feel as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now my back is, like, really going out.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, this is just my opinion again, because that's all you get from me, basically, is my opinion. Clinically, when I see people who are needing chiropractic over and over and over again, like they don't get their adjustment every 2 weeks and their back is in pain, that's a muscle issue. That's somebody who has too much freedom of motion, and what they need is core strengthening. So the chiropractic is a Band-Aid. It's a temporary fix,
okay. But
it's going to fall off, and then you're going to need another Band-Aid.
Okay.
So it doesn't go to the root of the problem. And so if I have somebody who comes in with that history, I give them my sales pitch and I say, okay, where you need to go, yes, we can do chiropractic to put you back when you break, Humpty, but we're also going to have you start doing physical therapy, and you're going to do these exercises every single day, and you're going to strengthen your core, and we're going to try to get you to the point where you hold together on your own.
Okay.
And that to me seems a much more sensible approach. So you probably haven't run through your physical therapy benefit. And my suggestion would be that you go back to your doctor and you say, okay, how about you fill me out a TAR for chiropractic and send
another
me,
one of those TARs,
and
though.
Send me to, no, but physical therapy probably won't need a TAR. So you're going to do the physical therapy and you want the chiropractic if you throw your back out doing physical therapy, but you're going to promise to try to get better. And it should be, you know, there's kind of like, it shouldn't be just this open checkbook for all the chiropractic that you want. If that's not really curative, if it's just palliative.
You're making a lot of sense for me. I need to hear this.
Yeah, my tax dollars at work, you know, I'm sorry you're in pain, but I want to pay for you to get better. I don't want to pay to slap a Band-Aid on this in perpetuity. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Good luck.
Oh, by the way, has there been anything in the bill regarding, nutrition for doctors? Maybe to
like some remedial education.
Well, just something to include that. And I'll get off the air.
Yeah, the answer to your question is yes. There has been a lot of effort to lobby them to include things like preventative medicine and nutrition education in the bill to encourage coverage for that. But it's too early. I mean, we're still at the stage of trying to get the foot through the door that, yes, indeed, there needs to be health care for all. If we can get that principle down, then we can worry about defining exactly what health care means. But if we don't have the health care for all piece sort of in the law to start with, we don't really even want to have to start that conversation. I don't want to start that conversation. When push comes to shove, I will be happy to put nutrition education and preventative therapy up against surgical treatment for obesity in terms of survival and cancer and all of the other things. And I have no doubt that prevention's going to win over surgery. So we'll fight that fight in a decade once we have the principle that treatment for obesity is everybody's right. Then we'll worry about what that treatment needs to be, and let's prove it that that's the best treatment. Sorry, getting a little vehement there. Let's go to Glenn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Glenn, and welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Good. I have a quick question and a comment on foot fungus.
Yes, a topic near and dear to many hearts, apparently.
I got a really bad case of athlete's foot, which caused little red dots and then erupted into giant blisters on the bottoms of my feet.
Isn't that lovely? Yes.
And I never got it between my toes. My primary question on that is, and I should have asked my doctor, I believe I got it from when I was staying at a hotel, and it showed up about, the little red dot showed up about 5 days after I had left. Does that sound like the right time frame?
Does, yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, because I've never had athlete's foot in my entire life.
Another possibility when it's on the bottoms and sides of your foot is that you were having not athlete's foot, but an allergic reaction to a chemical in a shoe.
Well, actually, when I looked this up, this variety, the blistering is actually an allergic reaction. At least one article claimed that.
Mm-hmm.
And the article had the weirdest thing to say. It said it often shows up as on both feet and one hand, or on one foot and both hands.
Yeah, my father had that for his entire life, and yes, it is extremely weird.
And what's on the hand, I think, is the allergic reaction, because I don't see any indication of any fungal infection on the hand.
It's,
I don't know.
Yes, this is a very strange phenomenon, and it is an observed and reported phenomenon. Don't ask me what it means or why it is, because I have no idea, but it is.
Okay, so my comment was that the doctor said, this is one of the most severe cases I've seen. I'd like you to take oral antifungal for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance company denied it. And when I called the drugstore, they said, oh, well, you could buy it yourself for $540. I'm thinking, $540 for 2 weeks?
Yeah.
I think they got that wrong, but I don't know.
No, actually, if it was daily, the $500 that I quoted for the toenail fungus, that's once a week therapy.
Oh,
and you do it for 3 months, and it's once a week, and that works because the toenails grow so slowly that all you have to do is kind of deposit some drug in.
Right.
You can deposit the drug in stripes, in other words.
This isn't toenail, so you do it daily.
Yes, you do it daily for 2 weeks because skin grows much faster.
So then I called the specialist, and she said, oh, gee, you could go to our favorite warehouse store. And they have it for much less, I understand. And so we got the prescription sent over there, and I went in to get 14 tablets, and it was under $10. That was the actual cost, because I have a copay that's over $10. So I was stunned. That was good news.
I think they might have changed the prescription on you to something that's available as a generic.
Bottle says Lamisil 250 milligram.
Terfenidine.
It actually said Lamisil on it.
Wow. Well, you got really lucky. Some computer burped somewhere, and it's your birthday, man.
Well, anyway, our warehouse store is quite generous and kind to us.
I'm sorry. I think their computer belched.
in the prescription drug department, they have a policy of keeping their prices low for you.
They really do, and we are fortunate that they have almost a Walmart level of corporate weight to throw around in the good cause of keeping our drug costs low.
Apparently with a more benign attitude, however.
Well, I wouldn't want to malign a major American corporation with lots of lawyers, so I'll let you say that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Bye-bye. I just want to make a parenthetical comment that I don't know why this is, but there are a few things that in medical radio over the years I have found to be true. And one of them is that everybody really cares about toenail fungus. Toenail fungus is just one of those topics that generates a lot of calls, and it sort of surprises me at some level, but I also find it kind of fun and amusing. So just wanted to share that one with you. We've got just a minute before the show ends, so I thought I'd throw out one cool thing. New for head lice. Back to school is coming up in a month or two. And there is a new FDA-approved non-drug application for head lice. It's 5% benzoyl alcohol lotion. And it's just put on the head. It smothers the lice. It's not neurotoxic like the other agents. And it is available there. So benzoyl alcohol for head lice. Now, I'm going off on vacation. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to have taped interviews. I do want to urge you to tune in to Ask Dr. Don. We've spent a lot of time trying to bring you the best of the experts out there. We've got a couple of really great interviews coming up, and so I'll be back on the second weekend in August to bring you more healthcare information and science in the news. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.